Numbers chapter 21. We're looking at a passage of Scripture today that is moving us forward to kind of a change of gears, a change of pace. I think you'll notice it as we read through this chapter, entitled the message this morning, Songs in the Desert. Chapter 21, verse 1, when the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Atharim, he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. Israel vowed a vow to the Lord and said, "If you'll indeed give this people into my hand, then I will devote their cities to destruction." The Lord heeded the voice of Israel and gave over the Canaanites, and they devoted them and their cities to destruction. So the name of the place was called Hormah. From Mount Hor, they set out by the way to the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient on the way. The people spoke against God and against Moses. "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no food and no water, and we loathe this worthless food." Then the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many people of Israel died. The people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned. We've spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he take away the serpents from us." So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole. Everyone who is bitten, when he sees it, shall live." So Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on a pole. And if a serpent bit anyone, he'd look at the bronze serpent and live. And the people of Israel set out and camped in Oboth. And they set out from Oboth and camped at Iyah Abarim in the wilderness that's opposite Moab toward the sunrise. From there they set out and camped in the valley of Zered. From there they set out and camped on the other side of the Arnon, which is the wilderness that extends from the border of the Amorites. For the Arnon is the border of Moab between Moab and the Amorites. Therefore it said in the book of the wars of the Lord, "Waheb in Sufa, and the valleys of Arnon, and the slopes of the valleys, that extends to the Sea of Ar, and leans to the border of Moab." From there they continued to Beer, that is the well of which the Lord said to Moses, "Gather the people together, so that I may give them water." Then Israel sang this song, "Spring up, O well, sing to it, the well that the princes made, and the nobles of the people dug, with the scepter, and with their staffs." And from the wilderness they went on to Matana, and from Matana to Nahaliel, and from Nahaliel to Bamoth, and from Bamoth to the valley lying in the region of Moab by the top of Pisgah that looks down on the desert. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, "Let me pass through your land. We will not turn aside into field or vineyard. We will not drink of the water of a well. We will go by the king's highway until we've passed through your territory." But Sihon would not allow Israel to pass through his territory. He gathered all his people together and went out against Israel to the wilderness and came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. And Israel defeated him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok as far as to the Ammonites, for the border of the Ammonites was strong. Israel took all these cities, and Israel settled in all the cities of the Amorites in Heshbon and in all its villages, for Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who fought against the former king of Moab, and taken all his land out of his hand, as far as the Arnon. Therefore, the ballad singers say, "Come to Heshbon, let it be built, let the city of Sihon be established. For fire came out from Heshbon, flame from the city of Sihon. It devoured Ar of Moab and swallowed the heights of the Arnon. Woe to you, O Moab! You are undone, O people of Chemosh. He has made his sons fugitives and his daughters captives to an Amorite king, Sihon. So he overthrew them. We overthrew them. Heshbon, as far as Dibon, perished, and we laid waste as far as Nophah. Fire spread as far as Medeba." Thus Israel lived in the land of the Amorites, and Moses sent to spy out Jazer, and they captured its villages and dispossessed the Amorites who were there. Then they turned and went up by the way to Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against them, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to Moses, "Do not fear him, for I have given him into your hand, and all his people and his land. And you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon." they defeated him and his sons and all his people until he had no survivor left, and they possessed his land. One of my favorite things is to go on an extremely cold night. We haven't had a lot of them recently, but early at the beginning of the year when it's down about zero or just a little bit below, you go outside, and on a clear night, it's crisp, and it's almost absolutely silent. I don't know if you were able to go out after one of the heavier snowfalls recently. We got that 8 inches of just really wet, heavy snow, and it dumped and it dropped. It was done by about 11:30 at night. I remember going outside and listening, and there was nothing. It was just absolutely silent, almost a majestic quiet, if you will. But then all of a sudden, spring happens. And what comes with spring? Well, all of a sudden you got noise, don't you? You got water dripping. I remember the day after we got that really heavy snow, it was melting all day the next day. I remember sitting in my office and just hearing drip, 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 everything running down the pipes and as it was running off the roof. All of a sudden the brooks begin to flow. That water has to go somewhere. The birds start singing in the morning. The buds begin to pop. The earth is alive. It's awake, both the sight and the sounds of life. I heard it this morning, just walking back over to the house. The birds singing, chirping. Something's coming to life when spring happens. When we're in the middle of winter, it's almost as though life just stops. The trees don't have leaves. The birds aren't singing. Things aren't running here and there. Everything's just still. It's dead. And where there's death, there's quiet. But as soon as there's life, there's noise, there's activity, there's busyness. And that's what it's like as we enter into this part of the text in the book of Numbers. We've seen that the book of Numbers happens in three different places. It starts out at Sinai for the first 10 chapters. Then there's a short interlude of travel before they go to the wilderness of Paran. They go to the wilderness of Paran and they wander. This is where most of the time frame happens. Some 38, 37 years or so happen in the wilderness of Paran. We don't have a lot of stories there, but we have enough of the story to give us a picture of a people who are in defeat, a people who are in retreat, a people who are in denial of the goodness of their God. And over and over and over again, there's rebellion, there's discontentment, there's fighting, there's strife, there's challenge. And all of these things mark a people of unbelief as they refuse to go into the promised land, as they stay in the wilderness. Now, they've already come out of Egypt. And God said they will get into Canaan, but because they refuse to go in, when they've come to Paran, God says, this generation will not. And we've come to see that even Moses, Miriam, and Aaron are all included in a generation that is exempt from the promised land because they failed to walk by faith. They walked by sight. They didn't trust in God, and consequently, they're refused access to this promised land. They're going to go to Moab, and that's where the book is going to close. They're going to be right across the river from Jericho, and they're going to set themselves up for the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses, in four speeches, is going to prime the next generation to go in and take control of the land. He's going to transfer his leadership to Joshua. He's going to go up on top of Mount Pisgah. He's going to overlook the entire land with those 120-year-old eyes, and he's going to see all of it. God's going to take his servant home, and he's going to bury him with his own hand. The only one in Scripture who ever is buried by the hand of God. Right now, we're in chapter 21. We're between the failure of the wilderness and the anticipation of Moab. And so we're right at that unique juncture in the story. And we've seen, this is the wilderness of Paran up here. They've been wandering in this region for 35, 36, 7 years. They've moved up to Kadesh. They were going to try to go through Edom, but they said no, and God said don't fight. So they're going to go down to the Red Sea, and then they're going to come up to Moab, and they're going to come up this direction. So this is what's happening. You see that this is what's, you see Mount, verse 4, from Mount Hor, they set out by the way to the Red Sea. So they're gonna go down so that they can go around Edom and then come back up and go across over to Jericho. But before they get there, something's going to happen. What I want us to see as we look at this passage today is that faith finds both its song and its voice in the desert. When we think of the desert, we think of death. We think of a place that's lifeless, that's barren, that's waterless, a place that you only go because you have to, not because you want to. But when God brings his people into the wilderness, into the desert, it's not a place of lifelessness. It's not a place primarily of death. That's not what he intends it for. Now, they keep claiming that. Why did you bring us out into the desert? To kill us? Why'd you bring us out here to die? But that's not God's purpose for his people in the desert. The desert becomes a very special place in the working of God in the lives of his people, where he creates a song in our hearts. And he gives our mouth the voice that we need to sing a new song so that many can see it and hear and can trust in our God. That's the purpose of the desert. And that's what God has wanted to do with a generation that refused to allow him to do it. But another generation is rising up, and they're learning to find their voice. They're learning to sing God's song, and the place that they're learning to do this is in the desert. There's four reasons that we find that we can sing, that we ought to sing, even in the desert. And the first is this: because God gives us victory where we once knew defeat. It's in the desert that God gives us victory where we once knew defeat. We see that as they're up there in Kadesh, the Canaanite king, king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that they're coming. He knows why they're coming, and rather than waiting for this group of people to come and take possession of the land, remember they've already sent spies in some 35 years ago, they've gone across these borders, they've camped right there, and so he strikes first, rather than waiting for them to come to him. He does so, he fights against Israel, and he takes some of them captive. Now, verse 2 is interesting. Who vows a vow to the Lord? In verse 2. Israel. Isn't that interesting? Well, maybe not. It should be. Okay. Israel vows a vow to the Lord and says, God, if you give us the victory, we'll give you all the spoils of this battle. What we find interesting here is it's not Moses who makes this vow. Aaron's dead, so it can't be Aaron. It's not Joshua who makes this vow. It's not the chiefs. It's not the leaders who makes this vow. It's the whole congregation. It's the whole people together. It's the people back in chapter 20, verse 1. The people of Israel, the whole congregation that's been coming together, all of them are the ones who are making up this decision. Back in verse 22, the journey from Kadesh, the people of Israel, the whole congregation come to Mount Hor. This whole congregation, there's an emphasis in the text that there's something different. The people now as a whole, as they've got struck, in fact, people are taken captive, they're captured and they're brought away. It looks like a defeat. But rather than rolling over and playing dead, rather than walking away and complaining and shaking their fists in the face of God and saying, why did you do this to me? The people as a whole turn to God and say, God, this can't be. This isn't right. You can't let this happen. You've got to work on behalf of your people. And we're willing to fight if you're willing to help us. And before they go and fight, they go to God. This is important because it's at this point in the narrative that something's happening. Something's changing. There's a decisive shift, if you will, as Israel begins to seek out her God. There comes a time as they've been. Look back in chapter 20, verse 29. When all the congregation saw that Aaron had perished, all of the house of Israel wept for Aaron for how many days? For 30 days. They've been sitting there, they've been weeping, they've been reflecting, been thinking about God's man, the man who's gone between them and God, a man who's spoken with the voice, with the words of God, a man who's interceded on their behalf. They're mourning his departure. Moses has been told that he's going to die, that he can't go in the promised land. They've seen Moses' failure. And now you would think, as they are camped there, they're getting ready for another move, and as they get themselves done with the mourning process, they're drying their handkerchiefs, they're wiping their eyes, they're getting back on their feet, they're getting ready to go, and boom, they're hit. They're hit with an attack. And you would think this would be a prime time for God's people just to roll over, just to be done. But they're not done. There's a time for them to move forward, and that time is now. They're not going to be held back by Aaron's death. They're not going to be held back by Moses' failure. In fact, there comes a time they're not even going to be held back by the failures of their parents in the previous generation. I like how Brown says this. He says, "Here is the story of Hormah revisited. This initial victory is won at the same place where they experienced an earlier defeat. The Lord is assuring them that in coming days, things will be different. By His grace and in His power, life can be different." Hormah, it might not ring a bell for you, but go back to chapter 14. Numbers chapter 14. Down at the end of the chapter, they're told, "You're going to die in the desert, folks. Because of your unbelief, you're going to die in the desert." Down in verse 44, they said, "No, we're going to go fight." Moses says, "Don't do it. It's done." Verse 44, "But they presumed to go up to the heights of the hill country, although neither the ark nor Moses departed out of the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and defeated them and pursued them even to Hormah." They were defeated and pursued to Hormah. But Hormah now becomes a place not of defeat, but a place of victory. In fact, it's the victory that should have taken place a generation ago. But it's a new generation that's willing to fight the battle. It's a new generation that's willing to seek God's face. It's a new generation that's willing to play by the rules of the people of God, in the presence of God, as the representatives of God. Wiersbe says, "Victorious Christian service, like the victorious Christian life, is a series of new beginnings. No matter what mistakes we've made, it's always too soon to quit." Have you found that to be true in your own life? You find that you make mistakes. Let's call them what they are. You've made sins. Committed sins. You've made mistakes. You've done the wrong thing. You've gone the wrong direction. You ever want to just quit? You ever want to just say, "Somebody else is going to have to do it. It's too big for me. Guess I'm just the big L loser. I can't even do this right. Okay, I'm just the loser. I'm a failure. I'm done." Listen. You're not done till you're dead. Because as long as you're alive, you have a living God who gives you hope. So have you made some big mistakes in your life? Have you done some big failures? Have you committed some big sins? You can shake your head this way. Yeah. Okay. But that doesn't exempt you from the battle. Victorious Christian life is lived by the man who, though he fall seven times, he riseth up again. Though he fall, he will not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholds him with his hand. You've walked with a child or a grandchild. You've been crossing a street. You've been walking across a lawn. You've hung on to that little hand, and all of a sudden the child trips on nothing, just a crack in the sidewalk or something, and all of a sudden they're going down. They're about ready to scrape their knee. But what do? Zip. And you keep on going. That's what God does for us. Do we stumble? Yep. in our immaturity, in our unchristlikeness, we stumble. But it's never time to quit. And this generation does something that a previous generation doesn't. Every single time we turned around before, the previous generation says, we're done. This is it. Forget it. We want to go back. Let's quit now while we're ahead. In fact, kill us. We wish we were dead in the desert because we're going to die anyway. Let's quit. Let's quit. Let's quit. Let's quit. This generation says, let's go. And it's not just because they're young. It's because they're operating by a different standard. How do we know that? We know that because they seek God's face. Verse 2, and Israel vowed a vow. What's the next phrase? To the Lord. They said this not to each other. They went to God and they said, God, please do this for us. They went to the Lord and they sought God's face. They didn't. You know, it's so easy for us to talk to people and not to God. And when we're in a grumbling mood, that's usually what we do. We go to somebody and say, can you believe it? Old so-and-so, you want us to go forward this direction. Doesn't look like that. It doesn't work like that. I can't believe this is happening. And we find commiseration on this kind of level. These people go directly to God with their problem. And they bring it together. The people of Israel go to God. They seek his face. And then they say, God, let us fight your enemies. They're our enemies because they're your enemies. Have you ever gotten tired of fighting against sin? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. You ever get tired fighting those battles? I get tired of them. I want to just say, forget it. I'm just going to give in. I'm just going to put it on cruise. God's going to forgive me anyway when I know where I'm going. No way. This people says, we're going to fight these enemies. They're our enemies because they're your enemies. We're your people. You're our God. And we're going to fight your battles because these enemies are your enemies. You know what? You've got to look at your sin that way. You've got to say, I'm going to fight this because I'm its enemy because I'm God's child. I'm going to fight God's battle. I'm going to fight God's enemies as God's people. And we see that they want to give God the glory. We see that at the end of verse 2. If you will indeed give this people, this enemy, into our hands, then we will devote their cities to destruction. The word there, devote to destruction, is a single word. It's the word H-E-R-E-M, harem. It's the word from which, at the end of the verse 3, we get the word chorma. Harem, chorma. It's the place of utter destruction. The idea is to be totally annihilated, to be separated unto God. And so they said, God, if you give us the victory there, we give all of the spoils to you. God, you're the one who has to give us the victory. You're the one who has to give them into our hand. You're the one who holds them. You're the one who can give them. And as you give us this victory, we give all of the proceeds, all of the spoils, all of the credit back to you. And we see that's exactly what happens. Degede gives us a little bit of an understanding, helping us to understand this devastation, this ban. We're going to look at this in greater detail in the afternoon service. But listen to what he says. The practice of total destruction of the cities of the enemies, or harem, was not a regular part of Israel's warfare throughout the ages. On the contrary, it was for the most part a unique and temporary feature, particularly associated with the conquest of the land of Canaan. Just as the possession of the land of Canaan of the Lord's people foreshadowed their heavenly inheritance, so too the slaughter of the present inhabitants was a foreshadowing of the final judgment of sinners by God. What happened in the conquest of Canaan was a visual depiction in time of that ultimate reality. This comprehensive judgment also serves two other important purposes in Israel's conquest campaign. First, it marks the battle as the Lord's, dedicating the spoils of victory to him. And second, it keeps this practice of total destruction of the Canaanites also removes the practical temptation for Israel to assimilate the ways of the inhabitants of the land. When I read that, probably disconnects for you. There's three things that God was doing through this program or this policy of utter destruction. The first was this. He was giving a picture of demarcating between God's people and God's enemies. He's going to say, go in and wipe them out, man, women, children. He's going to say in other parts, have no pity. Leave none alive. We've seen it before when the earth was judged in the time of Noah. We've seen it before when the fire falls from heaven in Sodom and Gomorrah. Men, women, children. Because they don't belong to God, because they've not exercised faith in God, are judged by God and wiped out by God. It becomes a very sobering reality of what's going to happen in the end of time, not on a physical level, though it will happen physically, but it's happening at a spiritual level. It's going to determine forever and forever and forever where I spend. Who am I a part of, God's people or those who are not a part of God's people? The second thing it does is it gives all credit to God. God, this belongs to you. It's not of my doing. It's all of yours. Number three, it keeps God's people separate from sin. And that's a big, big deal. God says, get rid of them because I've given you so many pictures. Back in Leviticus 11, back in Leviticus chapters 14 and 15, we've talked about how sin is like a cancer. We've talked about how sin is like a leprosy. We talk about how sin is like leaven, and it starts to spread, and it spreads throughout the whole, and it defiles and decays and causes death. You cannot afford to put yourself next to leaven without being leavened. And so he says, get rid of it. Cut it off. Remove it. Those are the three things that are working, and the people of Israel do it. There are people who are operating by faith. And as they exercise faith, God gives them victory where there once knew defeat. And we're going to see before this chapter is done, they're going to be singing. They're going to be rejoicing in the work that God is doing. DeGede writes, faith is the doorway to a whole new life. Faith is the stuff of life in the wilderness. You find it hard to live life in the wilderness? You can shake your head this way. It's tough. It seems like it's the place of death. It seems like it's the place without resources. It seems like it's a place without mirth, without song. But it's exactly the place where God is providing life, injecting life, and giving a song in the desert. We've seen that this is where they're at. And they're Horma right here. They're been at Kadesh Barnea, they're right down in this direction, and Horma becomes the place right on the edge of the promised land where God gives them their very first victory. A victory they should have had 35 years ago, but a victory that he gives them today, right in this area here. Number two, why should we sing in the midst of the desert? Because God offers us life, though poisoned by death. They start to complain again. Second verse, same as the first. This one's actually a little bit worse. Look at how they say this. Verse 5, the people speak against God and against Moses, and probably not necessarily in that order because they talk to Moses first, but they know that they're talking against God. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in this wilderness? Oh, here we go again. There's no food. There's no water. We've heard all these things before. Now look at this last line, verse 5. And we loathe this, what? Worthless food. Now they're not just complaining about stuff they don't have. They're complaining about stuff that they do have. You ever been there? Not you. Your kids have. Your spouse has. Not only are they complaining about all the stuff that they don't have, but they're complaining about the stuff that they do have. And the very stuff that they have, they're calling worthless food. What is the worthless food that they're talking about? It's the manna. It's the angels' food. It's the stuff from God for them. The stuff that God wasn't giving anybody else except to them in the wilderness right now. This is a big deal. What we're going to find is that even though this is a repeated refrain, it's like the chorus of the... This is really a song in the desert, but it's a song of the previous generation. Let's go to Deuteronomy. Keep your fingers here. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 2. This is a song that the parents have been teaching their children as they've walked through the desert. But let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 16. As soon as all the men of war had perished and were dead from among the people, the Lord said to me, today you're going to cross the border of Moab at Ar. In the very next pericope, in the very next story, we're going to find that they're on their way to Moab. They're on their way to Ar. This is the very last time this generation sings this chorus. Because after this, they're gone. After this, all the men who were numbered in that generation, among the warriors, among the census, the fighting men of Israel, after this episode, they're done, they're gone. And we're going to find that after this, children of Israel aren't complaining anymore. They're not looking to go back to Egypt. This is a big deal. This is a turning point, but it's a big turning point because we see that the poison is first in their hearts. It's the poison of fear. It's the poison of discontent. You see, in the wilderness isn't just the place of faith. It's also the place of fear. And we're going to articulate either faith or fear. And they continually articulate their fear. And they keep yearning for what was past. Egypt, that place of slavery, that place of bondage, that place of gods that are no gods, rather than looking forward to the place of the promised land given by the living God. The poison is first in their heart. It's a poison of fear, a poison of discontent. And then we see that this poison by God is going to be freed from their hearts. How does he do it? He does it in the form of snakes. Now, I wasn't aware of this, but this region of southern Israel and just below the Dead Sea is infested with snakes. Ever hear of Lawrence of Arabia? Okay. He was a real person. In ancient times, the area was notorious for its poisonous snakes. Lawrence of Arabia testified of it this way. There was a shuddering horror of all reptiles, and he makes special mention of their presence in this region. The plague of snakes, which had been with us since our first entry into this region, today rose to a memorable height. They became a terror. This year, the valley seems creeping with horned vipers, puff adders, cobras, and black snakes. Well, that's a nice mix, isn't it? It's like a snake cocktail there in the desert. By night, movement is dangerous. At last, we found it necessary to walk with sticks, beating the bushes while we step warily with our bare feet. They go on our nerves so that the boldest of us fears even to touch the ground. No, it's not just because there's naturally a lot of snakes in their region. But God specifically brings out a whole host of venomous serpents, and he begins to unleash their venom on the people. It's an appropriate thing, because the venom that's in their hearts is actually destroying them spiritually. And it's gonna wind up in death. Sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. The wages of sin is death. Okay. That's what's happening, and they don't even see it. God is going to connect some dots for them. He's going to send them these poisonous adders, and their venom is going to enter their bloodstream, and it's going to cause their hearts to fail. It's going to bring them to a conclusion. But it's in the middle of this biting by the snakes, and it's in the middle of this introduction of this physical venom that God is going to free them from the spiritual venom of their sin. Because it's at this point that they turn to Moses and they say, Moses, we've sinned. They repent. They own the fact that they've been going the wrong direction. So it probably wasn't just the old generation singing this song. It was probably part of the new generation. But as God is finishing wiping out that old generation of faithlessness, he's also shaping the heart of young, another generation that are learning faith. And he's bringing out that poison of sin that's blackening their hearts, that's causing them to die in the wilderness. And we have to understand what's going on here. As God says to Moses, well, let's read it. Verse 8, the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it or sees it, he shall live. It's a very, very simple verse. So Moses made a bronze serpent. He set it on a pole. If a serpent bit anyone, whoever looked at the bronze serpent lived. That's the story. That's all we have. Then we have Jesus quoting it in the New Testament in one verse in John 3:15. As the serpent was lifted up in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. No. What? Why a serpent? Why a fiery serpent? Well, where did Israel come from? Where had they been for 400 years? Egypt. Okay. What was the serpent to Egypt? What was the snake to Egypt? It was a god of fertility, a god of life. Okay. In fact, Pharaoh himself, on a little crown that he wore, right in the middle of his forehead, what comes up and is hanging over his forehead? It's a cobra. Okay? There's a snake. Egypt looked at the cobra, or at the snake, as a god of life. Remember what God says, the very first commandment? He brings his people out to Mount Sinai. He says the very first thing, thou shalt have no other gods before me. What God does at this moment is he takes one of the symbols of life, fertility, that they were very, very familiar with back in the realm of Egypt. And he's going to take it, and he's going to put it on a standard. He's going to put it on a pole. Both the serpent and the pole are symbols. The symbol is a rod of, well, remember when Aaron drops his rod and turns to a snake, and all of the other magicians drop their rods and it turns to snake. The rod is a symbol of authority. What God does is he says, Moses, I want you to take this serpent and I want you to to stick it up in front of everybody. I want my people to understand that when they look for a god other than me, they're looking in a place that brings only death. But I want you to take that serpent and I want you to stick it up on my rod of authority. And I want you to hang it there in front of everybody. And it's a serpent that's made out of what? Bronze. Okay. God had taken staffs and turned them into snakes that lived and ate, and they would grab them, and they turned back into a staff. But here God says, I want you to craft something that looks like a serpent. Does that serpent live or move or breathe or eat or do anything? It's stuck on top of this standard, this pole. What God does is he takes this symbol of his authority, sticks it down in front of everybody and says, you know what I do with death? I hang it out to dry. I defang it. I am the one who takes death and causes death to die. I want you to hang it, Moses, between heaven and earth. I want you to suspend it, so that everybody can see it, so that they can look and live. And verse 9 says, everybody who looked, lived. This is a resource that's available for everything. No wonder Jesus takes this symbol in particular and says, you know what? Not only is this a symbol of a false god, a symbol of an ancient past in Egypt, this points to the serpent. This points to the one who is the giver of death, the bringer of death. This is the one back in Genesis 3, verse 15, where God said, I will bring one who will, you will strike his heel, but he will crush your head. Jesus said, you know who I am? I am the one who hangs the serpent out to dry. But who's the one that's hung on a standard in the New Testament? It's Jesus, isn't it? And it looks as though Jesus is hanging on that cross, that Jesus is hanging on the standard of Satan's authority. But God is reversing all things. And as Jesus hangs on that cross, suffering the wrath of God, God himself is undoing the power of death and bringing life to any who will look and live. My friend, as we do life, we are sinners. We know what it is to complain, not just about the things we don't have, but about the things that we do have. We know what it's like to walk by sight rather than by faith. We know what it is to shake our fist in the face of God and say, I'm not going to do what you tell me. We're sinners. We know that. If we're honest with ourselves, we know that. And we know, and we're afraid, that the wages of sin is death. We know that the serpent isn't the way to life. We know that we need somebody to hang the serpent out to dry, to defang death. Know that it's only Jesus who can do that and has done that. My friend, I wonder today, have you looked so that you can live? Have you looked long enough at Jesus so that you can see that he is the answer to your sin? Not because mom and dad say so. Not because the preacher says so. But because you know, because God has worked this work in your heart. He's driven it home and brought you to the truth. If you look, you will live. Remember, it was a January morning back in early 1800s. A young man, he was 15 years old. He goes to a small chapel. In fact, it was so snowy that the ordinary preacher couldn't make it that day. So one of the deacons gets up and he starts to preach. And it wasn't a great sermon. But he says, there were about 10 people in the audience. And he looked at this young man and he said, son, look and live. Won't you look and live? And Charles Haddon Spurgeon, at the age of 15, walked out of that meeting a born-again believer. And England wasn't the same because God had worked a work in his heart. In fact, this symbol becomes so popular that it's on ambulances, it's on hospitals. You see it all around. The dead serpent because of the life of the living one. Very quickly, two more reasons that we find for singing in the desert. Number three, God gives us comfort by directing our steps. So we come down to verse 10. The people set out and they camped in Oboth. And then they camped at Iyeh Abarim. And then they go and they camp and they camp and they camp in all these different places. And then there's this beautiful little song that we come to verse 14. Waheb in Sufa, in the valleys of Arnon. And it's poetic. It's beautiful. And I love how one of the commentators says, we don't even know where it is. And that's the point. The point is, as God is bringing his people through the desert, he's bringing them from one nowhere place to another nowhere place, and he's bringing them through a succession of nowhere places, but he's bringing them to a somewhere place. You ever feel like you're in the middle of a bunch of nowhere places? Going to get up today and go nowhere. Get up today and go nowhere. God, we're just kind of wandering. Yeah. In fact, you saw the map. They're up by Canaan, and God's going to actually take them down away from Canaan, around Edom and up by Moab. Sometimes God's ways don't make sense to us. They just don't. We're in a nowhere place and we're going to a nowhere place. And in the middle of it, you get frustrated, don't you? Okay, maybe you don't. I do. God, I'm in a nowhere place, and it feels like I'm going to a nowhere place. But look at verse 13, verse 11. So they go from Oboth, a nowhere place. They camp at Ayi Abarim, another nowhere place. But they camp in the wilderness that's opposite what? The wilderness that's opposite Moab. Look at the last phrase in verse 11. Toward what? Huh. Why'd they put that in there? They had extra ink. They were just trying to get rid of words. The point is, there's something about to happen. The sun's about to rise. The darkness is almost done. We see up in verse 13, because Arnon is on the border of Moab. Verse 15, in fact, it leans on the border of Moab. In verse 20, they go from Bamoth to the valley lying in the region of Moab. God is bringing them from nowhere place to nowhere place to nowhere place to nowhere so that he can get them to a somewhere place. And my friend, while it feels like you're in the middle of nowhere, if you're God's child, you're never lost. As long as you're following him, he's bringing you to a somewhere place, and he's bringing you there on purpose. We looked at that in Deuteronomy 2. He told Moses, today, because everyone's dead, I want you to go here. Now we're going to go, but here's where I'm going with you. We're bringing you there. He's leading them to a destination, that is Moab. He's leading them to his provision. So verse 16, they continued to Beer. Beer means well. It's the well of which the Lord said to Moses, gather everybody together so I can give them water. And what actually happens here in this region of the Arnon, this Arnon River right down here in the south, this is Moab. And they're going to go up, talks about the Jabbok River, the Arnon River. Right in this region, there's, if you dig in these wadis, a wadi is a dried up river valley, but it's a place where water flows when there's extra water, but there's usually not. But digging in one certain place in this region, if you dig, the ground will fill up with water. It's a well. But it's shallower than most wells. God brings them just to the right place. In fact, it says that the leaders themselves lead in the digging. Everybody, again, together is joining in the work. But God brings them to a specific place where he gives them water in the desert. Where God brings life in the middle of death. And so they start to sing. This time, rather than complaining, I brought a couple of groups of teens down to Ironwood in the middle of the Mojave Desert, middle of summertime. We go out and we work during the day. We have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. In fact, we have to be at work at 5 o'clock in the morning. You know what they sound like at 5 o'clock in the morning? It's the lugubrious moo. Come on, wind them up. Okay. By about 10:30 in the morning, it's... Oh, hey, that's what we sound like. Here's a group of people, and it's time to dig in the middle of the desert. And you know what they do? Hey, let's sing. What's wrong with these people? You know what? They found their voice. They found their song in the middle of the desert. And God gives them water in a place like it looked like there was only death. Number four. The last reason that God gives us to sing in the desert is God gives us hope as we look to the future. There's two battles that take place, one with Sihon, king of the Amorites, the other with Og, king of Bashan. Sihon is the one that we see most, and Og is given to us in Deuteronomy chapter 3, verses 1 through 11. We get a little bit more of the story there. But what we see here in verses 21 down through the end of the chapter, two battles. The first battle is with an enemy who boasts in their past. Sihon, king of the Amorites. In fact, we get to a little poem down in verse 27, a ballad that the singers sing, and they celebrate a past victory of Sihon. Here's a man who defeated the Moabites. He put to subjection the people of the god Chemosh. In fact, Chemosh had to sell his children into slavery to the great and mighty Sihon, king of the Amorites. And it recites this poem of his great victories in the past. But then it gets down to verse 30. And then it says, we overthrew him. Heshbon, the very place that Sihon claimed as his own, yet we laid it waste. We spread the fire. So verse 31, thus Israel lived in the land of the Amorites. God says, I'm going to give you his field. Look at verse 24. Israel defeated him with the edge of the sword, and he did what? He took possession of his land. He took possession of his land. This great, mighty king. Now, Sihon is a big deal. He had defeated the Moabites. He's proven himself. But we're going to move a little farther north. We're going to move up into this region. So we've come up this direction. Heshbon, he's moved the Moabites out. Ammon is there. We're going to fight all the way up to Edrei. Here's where we find out the story of Og. This isn't the Wizard of Og. Okay, this is Og, a guy whose bed is 13 and a half feet long. His bed is at least 6 feet wide. You've heard of a king-size bed? Okay, this is a king-size bed. He is one of the giants that back in chapter 14, the people of Israel said, we can't go in the land. There's too many giants, right? Well, here's another generation who's learned to walk by faith rather than by sight. And you know what they're going to do? They're going to go take on the giants. This isn't just a giant in lore. This isn't just a giant in ballad. This isn't just a giant in song. This is a guy who is mammoth. He's tall. He's probably bigger than Goliath. They said, yeah, you know what? That's what we're going to do. We're going to fight him. Verse 34. Well, verse 33. They turned, went up to Bashan. Og, the king of Bashan, comes out against them. He and all his people to the battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to Moses, don't fear him, for I've given him into your hand and all his people and his land. Moses, I'm going to give you Og. I'm going to give you all his people who, like the giant, are probably gigantic. All right? We're going to see later on that he kills all, verse 35, he defeats all his sons, the successors of the giant, and all his people, and they possess his land. That's the last words in chapter 21. And they possessed his land. My friend, don't you want to sing? You know, in the desert, God has designed a song. Because God has designed the desert for life. Here's the song that he wants us to sing. He wants us to sing about victories where we once knew defeat. Have you wrestled with sin? Has Satan beat you up in the past? Have you felt like you're never going to win the battle? God says, you're not dead. You've got life. You've got hope. You've got Jesus Christ. You've got me with you. We're going to get up and we're going to keep fighting this next battle. He offers us life, though poisoned by death. We've looked to Jesus, the slayer of the serpent, and he's given us life. He gives us comfort by directing our steps to a certain place, to certain provisions, and he gives us hope as we look to the future, because in the middle of this desert, it's not just faith that finds a song and a voice in the desert. Fear does as well. Both faith and fear will find a song and a voice in the desert, but they're two different songs. But it's faith, not fear, that overwhelmingly shapes the song and regularly tunes the hearts of God's people. My friend, what song are you singing today in your desert? Are you rejoicing that the Lord is king? Or are you grumbling and whining and complaining with a lugubrious moo? We don't have to sing that song, because God's given us a new song in our hearts. Even praise unto our God. Many will see it and fear and trust in the Lord. Let's pray.